Welcome to the Special Sauce Podcast, real conversations about food and life, hosted by Serious Eats founder, Ed Levine.
There's a lot of responsibility, irrespective of other person's religion, gender, sex. Who cares what they believe in? Who cares what they practice? If they are hungry, it is your responsibility to feed them. If you have food, you got to go share it with them.
On this episode of Special Sauce, we hear the harrowing but ultimately hopeful story of Sibte Hassan, a Brooklyn-based restaurateur who contracted the coronavirus in April, survived, and came through the experience with a new set of life priorities. ...2021 is upon us, and the pandemic continues to wreak psychological and economic havoc on restaurants and the millions of people who depend on those restaurants for their livelihood. But one of the things I've been curious about is what happens to people in the food culture who actually contract the virus. I want to hear their stories. Sibte Hassan, the chef and owner of BK Johnny, a seriously delicious halal restaurant he opened in 2015 in Brooklyn, is one of those unfortunate people. Welcome to Special Sauce, Sibte. Let me start by saying that I am a fervent devotee of BK Johnny food. I just had to say that right off the bat.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
So before we get to you contracting the virus, I'd like to hear a little bit about what your life was like and how did you come to open BK Johnny?
One of my friends took me to this place in Astoria saying, you're going to have the best halal burger of your life. I was very excited. I used to eat non-halal items at that point. So I've had JG Melon, I've been to Medetta Tavern, I've tried and tested all the burgers, and I like those. And I said, okay, I'm going to go. And I saw the patty being put on the grill. I knew what I was going into, but I still gave them a benefit of doubt. And then the burger was served. I took a first bite. It was the most disgusting burger I've ever had. And I just pushed it over to my friend. I said, this is the most disgusting thing. And he goes, what are you talking about? It's the best. And he devoured mine too. And I told him, I said, okay, one day when I have a chance, I will make a burger joint and I will show you how a burger should be.
You weren't in the food world before that.
I was not in the food world at all. I've never worked in a restaurant. My career is based on graphics, visual design, animation, photography. I went to Parsons and I did my master's in fine arts in design and technology way back in 2004. So I've been in design all my life.
So you do not have a master's in burgers?
Absolutely not.
And so you opened BK Johnny in 2015?
That is correct.
And how did you raise the money for it?
That is a very happy story. It was most of my own personal funds, and actually all of my personal funds. And I took the biggest risk of starting something which I've never done before.
Wow.
And that is my personal trait. Like, I like to take gigantic risks. I'm not afraid of failing. I'm going to be okay if I fail, but I'm going to learn something. And before that, I had another little project going on. And before that, another one. I was like, well, what's going to happen? I'm going to fail again? No problem. And then slowly and gradually, it started taking off. And it was not big. Nothing was big till the New York Times article came out in April.
April of 2016 or 17?
2016. 6 months after I opened up, the article came up. And after 3 months, I saw the results. I saw people coming in and lining up. And that was it.
Life was good.
Life was getting there. But since I've never worked in a restaurant before, I had no clue about a lot of things. And I can share a million stories about my restaurant experience. If you were to come to my restaurant in 2015, 16, 17-ish, and you order a chicken tikka, it'll take 45 to 50 minutes.
Wow.
And people waited. The best part is nobody ever complained about the wait because they saw there is a piece of chicken on the grill, which I'm tending to, and out comes the most flavorful, super nice piece of chicken. So nobody ever complained. Everybody was patient, and I used to tell them, like, bring a book or bring a friend and talk to them while I cook your food.
But it got better. So things were going okay.
Yeah, things were great.
Things were great. You had people coming to the restaurant. You were learning how to run a restaurant on the fly, of course, but that's the way most of us learn a lot of things. And then what happened when you found out you had the virus? New York was already in lockdown?
This was March of this year when we came to this new place in East Williamsburg. My previous one was in Bushwick. And then I moved my locations and we came to East Williamsburg location. March 3rd, I opened this up for friends and family. March 6th, we start our commercial process of charging people for food. And March 20th, when we go into a lockdown.
Wow, that's crazy. So you weren't feeling well. What actually made you think that you had the virus?
So, you know how everybody likes to have a New Year's resolution in the last week of December of every year. Oh, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. My resolution was that I'm not going to skip on any vitamins, supplements that are needed for my health. So on 1st of January, I started to take all my vitamins once a day, every day. I'm not going to skip anything. Because every winter, I would get a little bit of a cough or a little bit uneasy, especially the dead of winter. So at this time, I thought, okay, maybe because I'm exerting so much time, standing up, working all the time, my body gets weak. I need to supplement with vitamins and all the good stuff. Back of my mind, I was thinking, that I'm going to be fine. And when this pandemic is going to start, I was like, oh, it's going to be okay. It's just another flu. No big deal. I was not wearing a mask throughout when this whole thing started. I was careless. I was careless because of misinformation that I got from a couple of my customers who happened to be doctors and said, well, our genetics are pretty much gifted because we don't have the enzyme, which is the gateway for this coronavirus to come in. I said, what is that? And he said, it's called ACE2. We are very low on ACE2, so we should be fine. I said, okay, no problem. That's good news. I was still careless, but I was sanitizing. I mean, being in a restaurant, you got to sanitize everything, and you cannot be careless about that part. So now I'm sanitizing my hand, but I'm still not wearing a mask. I was in the front of the house, being the cashier, getting the orders to people, talking to them, welcoming them. And my customers would walk all the way over. And they were not wearing a mask. I'm not wearing a mask. And they would place an order. They were literally like 3 feet away from me. And I think the viral load got so much that I started to get sick. And that happened on April the 3rd when I had fever for the first time. Usually fever happens 3 days, 2 days, and then I'm done. A couple of Tylenols, a couple of Motrins here and there, orange juice. And I'm fine. So this was the 8th day that I'm home and my temperature keeps rising back up to 102.3, 102.5, 102.8. And one of my customers is a doctor. And I relayed all my information to him and he happened to send me over a pulse oximeter. So you could stick your finger in, check your heart rate, and check your oxygen level. So laying down in my bed, my resting heart rate was between 110 and 115. And my oxygen was dropping. It was 88 when I checked on it. And then when I called him up, and he said, you need to go to the hospital now. While I am in bed, and I'm thinking, like, I think the pulse oximeter is not working correctly because I'm in bed. How can it be 110 beats per minute? And that's when he said, no, you got to go. And just to step back from this part, that morning, 3 a.m., I called 911 when my temperature was not going down. And the woman calmly told me over the phone, you're breathing okay. You're not short of breath. Take some Tylenol. Don't go overboard more than I think she said was 2,400 or 2,000 milligrams of Tylenol in 24 hours. You should be fine. So she kind of talked me out of going to ER. And 8 hours later, when I called up my doctor friend, my customer, who happens to be a doctor, and he said, you're going to the hospital now.
Wow.
I go to the hospital. So they had the tent outside in the parking. It was very, very cold that day, I remember. And I sat in there, waited, got in for my checkup. They checked me out. They did my x-ray. And as soon as the technician took the x-ray, he called over the doctors. All three doctors popped over. They looked over, they just glanced, and within a second, they were like, yep, that's COVID, and we are not going to let you go home. So I was admitted for 12 days at New York Presbyterian in Queens.
12 days?
Yeah.
And what were those 12 days like?
I've never been to Six Flags, but I can tell you, I would call it 60 Flags. It was the most interesting 12 days of my life. I was going in to a hospital when I know that people are dying left and right. And I was mentally prepared. I was like, this is it. So if this is going to be it, I'm going to be going with a very conscious mind. I'm not going to be scared. I'm never going to be scared of death. I'm going to embrace it with complete open arms and figure out the right way and not going to be creating a chaos for the people who are going to be behind me. Knowing the fact that I do not have a family here at all. I've got really good group of friends, super caring, more than family. And I unlocked my iPhone. I collected all my passwords into a little document. And I called up two of my friends and I told them where they will be able to find everything. So they don't have to wait for Apple to unlock my phone and show my death certificate and give this a power of attorney and go all through the legal systems. They should be able to see all the information immediately. And I gave them a little bit instructions of what to do. And I went in and my doctors took really, really good care of me, especially the nurses. Everything was monitored. They were checking on me. The first 6 days, they were just trying to control my temperature and my vitals. They were kind of struggling because for them, it was still new. They didn't really know what is going to work, what is not going to work. Probably it was the 11th or the 12th day I was on hydrochloroquine. I'm not sure exactly the number of days, but that was a long time. Then they changed my steroids. And there was a steroid, I remember, the last three numbers on the steroid was 106. I'm not sure the brand or the name. That really helped in getting my oxygen level back. And on the 8th day, one of the doctors who came in the morning, he said, we got a couple of days for you to recover your oxygen levels to a little bit of a normal side. But otherwise, we have to take you into the ICU and we have to put you on a ventilator. And I started laughing and I said, okay, let's go. And he was shocked. He was like, what do you mean? I said, if I'm going to go, then let's go. I'm not going to tell you like no. And he goes, no, that's not the point. I want you to work on your oxygen and do something. I'm like, first of all, I don't know what I'm supposed to do, but I will try. And I was laughing and he was kind of awkwardly looking at my face like, what is wrong with this guy? Because it is what it is. I'm not going to be shy about it. And one thing which really worked was what I heard from nurses and doctors, if somebody taps or pats it really hard on your back, that revives a lot of blood flow in your lungs and brings up the oxygen level. So my oxygen level will go down to, let's say, 86 while I was in the hospital. I will lay face down and would ask someone, like a nurse, to come in and slap the hell out of my back. And that would really help. My levels would go up rapidly to 90, 92 in the next 15, 20 minutes.
Wow.
And the doctors prescribed that I should just stay in that position as long as I can, knowing I'm a quite a restless brain. And at that point, I could stay in one position for 3 hours, not move, 4 hours one day, 3 hours one day, and just lay there. And that helped me revive my oxygen levels to a point after which the 10th day when I was in the hospital, they lowered down my oxygen because I wasn't a breather, that little transparent mask they put on your nose and mouth. And then they lowered the oxygen levels in that breather, and slowly they monitored and they figured out that I'm going to be okay to go home if my body starts to recover, which it did. One more thing which was most interesting in those 12 days, I could not sleep. And they gave me Xanax, they gave me Ambien, they gave me Abilify, I don't know, whatever they gave me. I could not sleep. So I basically slept for 40 to 45 hours or less in those 12 days. I was waiting for the bright, warm light that everybody talks about when you read about somebody's near-death experience or out-of-body experience. They always talk about this bright, white light, and I was waiting for that bright light to show up so we could depart, and that didn't happen.
Fortunately, as you're about to hear, Sipte never saw those bright, white lights in the hospital. What happened instead? So you were well enough to go home after 12 days in the hospital?
I was recovering. They said you should be fine, and now you're going to just recover slowly at home. So my nurse manager, her name is Elaine. I give a lot of credit to her. She was the cheerleader during this whole 12 days of my hospitalization. She would come in at 8 in the morning and ask me how am I feeling, what's going on. Her energy level was contagious. Even though you don't feel like responding, you probably had 2 hours of sleep, but her energy would wake you up and you have to respond. One day she walked in and she said, Mr. Hassan, what are we doing tonight? Are we going dancing? I'm not a dancer. I don't dance. I've never been to dancing and all this stuff, but I started like laughing in my head, like, okay, we can go dancing, but more of a symbolic dancing, like, okay, we're going to do this and we're going to be fine. And that really, really was helpful in ways when you are thinking, you're planning, okay, how's it going to be when you depart this world and where you're going to be and what things that you all read about growing up and the fascination that you're scared about something. And I'm not going to be scared about something. I'm going to see, will I be able to remember everything? And will I be able to recall my memories? And will I everything is going to be in a flash and all those things. And when you're thinking about all those things while you're in isolation in a room, when there's a little TV on the wall, which only has 3 channels, and you're listening to Cuomo every day describing 1,092 deaths today, and your monitors are beeping left and right, and you're just concentrating on absorbing everything and seeing what's happening right now. You know how people say be in the present? That was quite being in the present all this time. I was wide awake, absorbing everything, seeing how things are going to be. And in the back of my head, I was thinking, where is this warm light? Let's go. But then Elaine would show up and she would say something and that would be like, okay, life. We got to move on in this world. Maybe it's not my time. That happened for all those 12 days.
Wow, that's crazy. You're much more philosophically attuned to accepting that you might not survive. Where does that come from? It sounds like you weren't as terrified as I would be.
I was not terrified at all. The one thing which terrifies me the most, I will tell you what that is. It's not death. What terrifies me the most is the helplessness. I don't want to be helpless. I knew that I'm in a hospital, I'll be fine. I have help over here. But beyond this, I don't want to be helpless. If I'm going to go, I should go quick, be done, and not just sit there and not be able to do anything. So when you realize that the helplessness is not going to happen and you have the power, you are going to be mobile, you're going to be talking, you're going to be doing everything, that gives you this endless energy, which is more of a mental thing than physical, because physically I'm still tired. I am tired, but it's going to be fine. I know I'm going to recover completely. It's going to be a little bit longer than expected. It's also the fact that how intense it was. Both lungs were swollen to the max. When the doctor would come in at 8 in the morning, ask me to take a deep breath, my deep breath would last half a second. And that would say, like, take a deep breath. I'm like, that's it. This is my deep breath. I cannot go beyond that. So they would, okay, you're going to be fine. So my body took a lot of toll, but that was physical. Emotionally, it was in a different level. My physical energy is entirely different. I'm in a body. My emotional level is entirely different. I can carry on, and I'm carrying on, and my body will follow. That's what I learned from this thing. And it's fun. I'm actually seeing a lot of new facets of my own self, like how much strength I had, which was untapped before, and now I'm much, much stronger emotionally than physical.
Wow, that's so interesting. And what was going on at the restaurant during all this?
First of all, I'm really blessed with their super nice, super cool people. And I told them, I said, everybody go home. Wait for 7-10 days. If there are symptoms, we're going to go. And you guys are going to go get tested. Otherwise, just go home and rest. And 10 days later, I told them to come back. And we were just doing deliveries and pickups. They were quite supportive of me being gone. I didn't get any phone calls from them. Oh, this is missing or that's missing. They took care of everything.
And did the restaurant do enough business to stay together?
No, it wasn't. But I had to keep my team running with me. I'm not going to let them go. As I've seen a lot of people, as soon as there's a drop in the sale, everybody go home. They want to save on the labor. They want to save some money. I'm not going to let my people go. Where are they going to go? I should be taking care of my people. They've been with me for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. I'm not going to be like over a month of sale or 2 months of sale or 3 months of sale should be telling them, okay, your time is up. I cannot afford you. Bye. They have taken care of my business and I'm going to take care of them. So if it takes 3 months, I will. If I'm run out of money, I will call up my friends. And my people are going to be my people. I'm not going to let them go. So slowly and gradually, when I came back from the hospital, May 5th, I walked out of the house for the first time. And I came to the restaurant, and slowly and gradually, everything came to a point where it could be, we are still surviving. We were fine.
And how now do you spend the bulk of your time? Because one of the things I read about was that you talked about when you got out, you started thinking about how people are fed in Pakistan, and you grew up in Lahore, right?
Lahore, yes.
So tell us about that.
So before I went to the hospital and this whole pandemic was picking up a lot of pace, I was introduced to Anna. I'm forgetting how to pronounce her last name, but she started Meals for Heroes. Her idea was that these restaurants need to be supported in a way that can support the hospital workers. So what she did was she collected money from friends and family. She picked up restaurants, told them to make 100 meals, 50 meals, 150, depending on the hospital she's sending, going to be sending them over to. So the hospital workers will have a different meal every day because they are the ones who are actually on the front lines and they are taking a lot of emotional and physical toll. So this will be something for them. Let's make something for uplifting their spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So not every day they're going to get a pizza. Not every day they're going to get the same food again and again. So she worked on this idea of getting restaurants to cook for the hospitals. I didn't tell anybody that I'm getting sick. When I was in hospital, I coordinated a 200 meal delivery at Kings County Hospital. And then when they asked me for more and my staff was gone home, and I told them, I said, guys, when I get back, I will continue. I'm in the hospital and I contracted the virus. So when I came back, And I spoke to Anna, and then we talked about getting the food out quick, because I could see what really helped me hold on to the rope of this world was the behavior, the coolness, the calmness, being on point with me during my 10, 12 days of hospital was the nurses. These nurses, these frontline workers, are always there. When you ring the bell, somebody's going to show up, and they are not going to show up with a frowny face. They are not going to show up with as if you are bothering them. They will show up and they will knock on the door and come in and ask you if you want anything. And especially Elaine, that episode really helped me out, and I figured out they need to be celebrated more than what they are being done now. So I was already doing with stuff with Anna. Then I came back, started doing the hospital food, and I was happy that I am standing on my 2 feet, cooking 200 meals for these hospital people. I don't know them. They're in a different hospital, but I can understand what kind of emotions they are probably going through right now, because they're going to be scared, they're going to be tired and all the stuff. So at least if I can give them some sort of happiness, some sort of delicious food to hold themselves up, I might as well be doing that every day. So we did that for a long time. And the spirit from which I ran with, it's not just like I'm a born saint. I'm not. I think I'm opposite to a saint. But I grew up in Lahore, and that's a quite a dense place when it comes to the Sufi shrines and spiritual Sufis. You go to their shrine, any shrine, you want to pay homage, and then you will be given some food, because nobody knows who you are, where you're coming from. You might be a traveler. So there's a tradition of feeding the unknown. Without knowing their caste, their religion, their gender, their age, you just need to feed someone. That's the idea, feed someone. You don't know their situation, just feed them. So carrying that tradition on, and I just did the same thing. I'm going to send food to people in the hospital. And I did that for a long time with the help of Meals for Heroes. And then once that was going out, I saw restaurants closing down left and right, people out of work, people on the streets. A lot of people will knock on my door, come in and ask for a job. I cannot afford to keep more people, but I could see there's a lot of distress amongst the community that we live in. And then I call up my friend, and she happens to be working for a nonprofit called Meals. It's called Muslims Against Hunger. And we started with giving them food. So I started with 50 boxes of lentils and rice. And now lentil and rice is the traditional meal that you will find out on a shrine in Lahore. Just lentils and rice. And if you eat that, it just fills you up, gets you going, and it's the greatest thing ever. And I did the same thing. I started giving them lentils and rice because it's vegan, it's vegetarian, and it's also gluten-free for all those gluten-free people out there. And it just started to work that way. And I gave them 50 for the first time, 75 for the next time, a couple of weeks of 75, and then 100. And now we are up to 400 a week.
Wow.
And that triggered, I called up other people, let other people know that this is what I want to do and I want to feed my community. And the word got out slowly and gradually. Then I got a text message from the fridge project. Every neighborhood has a little fridge. You can take anything out, you can put anything in. I started working with them.
What does the fridge project do?
The fridge project is quite interesting. What the people do is actually they put a fridge out on a storefront, irrespective of what the store does. And it says in English, free food. And in Spanish is comida gratis or gratis comida. And you can just walk by, open the fridge, see if you want something, maybe an apple, maybe a banana, maybe a meal or a yogurt. You can just take it and somebody's going to fill it up. It's just an exchange place, and you could just treat yourself to anything. I was sitting outside at a Turkish coffee shop, and I'm looking at this fridge, painted, writing on it, graffiti going on. And this woman walks by with three kids. She opens the door. She takes out a gallon of milk, picks up three bags of vegetables, and one more thing, I forgot what that was, maybe a bread or something. And she walked away with her kids. She had a smile on her face, a big smile on her face. There was a sense of relaxation on her face that she found food. So why not continue that? I was just thinking like that. Okay, I should do something about it. And a week later, I got this text message about this fridge project. Would you be interested in participating? I said, absolutely. So I started doing that. And now I'm sending food to Coney Island Avenue. There's a youth organization called Pakistan Youth Organization, and they distribute 300 meals. And then in the fridges, I do, I think, 170 meals. And I just send 75 meals to Marcy Projects. So the numbers are going up, which makes me really, really happy. And there was a voice note my coordinator from the Marcy Project sent me over about this guy, how he enjoyed the meal, how he gave it to this person and two to that person. And there was a sense of satisfaction. And again, the word relaxation, because food at the end of the day is the most basic need of a human. And I'm tapping into that. And I'm really, really, really happy that I can facilitate at least one person.
You're feeding a lot of people. And obviously, the pandemic has produced exponentially more people who don't have enough to eat. It sounds like, in part, your experience of having COVID put you in the frame of mind of wanting to spend the bulk of your time doing this kind of stuff.
I think the COVID made more relevant for people to help me out. I was doing this before also, but very, very under the covers, because there is a saying, I'm forgetting it, maybe it's Islamic, like maybe from the religion or maybe the culture. When you give from your right hand, your left hand should not know. And this comes from my parents. When I started driving, my mom used to support 7 families, and my dad used to support 9 families. And me and my dad would go to a gigantic store, fill up the trunk, fill up the back seat. We would get oil, sugar, lentils, rice, flour, all the good stuff. We would make rounds to people's houses, and we would go after hours, after the sun is down, and usually just go quietly, park the car somewhere far away, and walk those bags over to the house, shake their hand, make sure everything is okay, and walk away. And do not make a complete show out of it. People should not know, and the host of the house should not be obligated to give you tea and celebrate you. Like, no, it should be just in and out, be done with it. Like, don't try to feed your ego with this.
That was in Pakistan.
Yep, that's in Lahore. My dad used to tell me, like, this is between you and me. Mom should not know. My brothers will not know. Nobody know. And my mom used to do the same thing. Me and my mom, we would go 7 houses. And we would go and drop stuff off. And then again, the same thing. Nobody should ever know. Nobody should know the name. Nobody should know anything. It's all about privacy. And the funny part was that I was in the middle of both, and they're not telling each other. And they're my parents, which is like, come on, you would be exchanging notes about this. But no, they're not going to be doing that. One woman I remember clearly, she was related to us like pretty far away, second, third, fourth cousin, whatever. She was a widow. She didn't have any kids around. And me and my mom used to go and drop stuff off. And when my mom passed away, I wasn't already in the U.S. My mom passed away, and she waited for my mom to show up 3 months. And when she heard the news of my mom passing away, within 3 weeks, she passed away herself.
Wow.
So there's a lot of responsibility as a human that we have, irrespective of other person's religion, gender, sect, whatever they believe in. Who cares what they believe in? Who cares what they practice? If they are hungry, it is your responsibility to feed them. If you have food, you got to go share it with them. And being a Muslim, being a Shia, being a Lahori, being a Punjabi, I cannot be okay with my community, my neighbors, my friends to be hungry when I have a commercial kitchen in Brooklyn, in New York, and I'm not feeding them enough, that's not fun. That's absolutely not fun. So if I were to do the same before COVID, people would be like, cool story, and walk away. But since it's COVID and everybody is on the alert and everybody understands a little bit of suffering, so now there's a little heightened sense of food insecurity. So people are actually understanding my cause, what's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're spending the bulk of your time on something you started semi-officially called the Dal Chawal Project, right?
Yeah, the Dal Chawal Project. Dal is the lentil. Chawal is rice. And I call it the Dal Chawal Project.
It's just a sort of container to hold all of the things that you're doing to feed people.
Correct. That is a platform which I started so people could send me money and I can make lentil and rice. And I got a request to make a better lentil rice, which means better in the sense of like add some meat in there, bro. I was feeding them lentils and rice for 6 weeks and this ad requested. So I said, sure, it's a 2.0. So I'm going to add some meat here and there. So I'm going to separate some meat containers with regular stuff because you don't know who's vegetarian or who's vegan.
And how is BK Johnny doing? Are you guys going to survive?
We will survive. And I can tell you why we're going to survive. We are not hitting the sales right now. If you find a reason and if you find a connection to help somebody else, you will be given the resource and the sale and every support around you to survive. I can guarantee one thing. If I do not support people, if I do not care about what's happening around me, my business will fold pretty quick. And I can 110% guarantee I will survive because I'm not just selling burgers and lamb chops and steaks. I'm actually using this space to make the food for the underprivileged. And talk about karma, talk about the relaxation, the comfort, the smiles I might be getting from the unknown people who are like 2 miles away or 10 miles away or wherever my food is going. That energy is going to keep me afloat. And when the temperature hits 32 degrees and I'm looking at my staff like, this is going to be a dead day, we get slammed with orders. Where are those orders coming from? I have no idea. When it's 52 degrees outside and I'm thinking we are going to be slammed today, it's going to be okay. But averagely, I'm perfectly fine. I will survive this whole situation as long as I know that I'm helping the unknown people around me. And as long as I have not disconnecting that connection that I have created, I'll be fine.
And you're trying to go around the country with Dal Chawal Project, right? You're looking to make this a much bigger, broader initiative.
Yes. I want people to understand it's just not going to be a New York thing. When they see people around them and they want to do something, I'll give you the recipe. Go home, cook a meal, pack it up, go deliver. Imagine the smile on a person's face when they see a home-cooked meal that you actually took the time, not just giving them a dollar or two, but you actually brought them food that you made yourself.
That's amazing. And how are you feeling physically?
So, do you drive?
I do. I have driven.
And when your fuel level goes to yellow and the light comes on, right? It's a sense of little bit your heart rate goes 5 beats extra per minute. But like, oh, I gotta get gas. And then you get gas, but you don't fill it up. You get 1 gallon of gas so the light can go off. And then a few hours later, your light goes on. So imagine controlling that burn and fill up, burn and fill up. That's where I'm at right now.
Yeah.
So I'm perfectly fine. I'm happy. I'm really, really, really happy that I'm able to do all what I'm doing. And I can see that this is not going to be just a 300 meal a day situation or 300, 400 meals a week situation. This is going to be bigger, better, and it's just going to be a mini heaven. mini heaven, because I'll be able to do things and bring smile on people's faces and introduce them to my Punjabi culture. When I say Punjabi culture, is my lentils and rice. That's Punjabi. The recipe is Punjabi. So for me, just to see people nodding agreement to the taste that they're having right now is priceless.
Yeah, but on the other hand, your fuel light is on.
It's okay. It's okay. It doesn't matter, because my fuel comes from when I get a response from people. And if I keep on doing that, I will keep on getting response. And that response will slowly grow bigger and bigger and bigger. I'll be fine.
Yeah.
And my health is going to be okay.
Is it getting better sort of slightly week by week?
Slowly, yes. My stamina is back. I can work 12 hours a day. Ask me to pick up 40-pound box of chicken and walk it downstairs. I can do it once. I can do it twice. I used to be able to do unlimited, but I can do it twice or thrice, and then I take a 5-minute break and do it again.
And are you sleeping?
Yes. I have a very consistent sleep of 6 hours, nothing more than that. I cannot go beyond 6 hours.
You've obviously learned so much during this experience. What's the one thing that you have taken away from this experience that you can share?
The answer to that great question is, there is no tomorrow.
Meaning that you shouldn't be spending any of your time doing things that are seemingly frivolous. You have to sort of embrace whatever you're doing to the max.
Absolutely.
And is that part of the wisdom you can impart from your experience? Is there one thing you'd like to impart to listeners of Special Sauce and the world for that matter?
One thing I would like to say to the listeners is try to be more empathetic. Try to be in other people's shoes and try to be less selfish.
That was the same thing that Obama's mother told him when he was a teenager. I'm reading Obama's book, so I can say that. I've just gotten to that part. So you and Obama are in the same camp.
He's also a Leo, just so you know.
Got it. Sipte Hassan, thank you so much for sharing your very scary and yet inspiring story.
Thank you so much for having me.
We wish you only good things for Dal Chawal, BK Johnny, your health and well-being, and your continuing endeavors to feed the hungry.
Thank you so much.
That's it for this episode of Special Sauce. We'll be back with new episodes every 2 weeks. In the meantime, please stay safe and healthy this holiday season. And again, I urge you to do everything you can to support your local restaurants and the purveyors that supply them. The pandemic has wreaked havoc on the restaurants we all know and love. Sadly, the latest COVID relief package passed by Congress doesn't do nearly enough for those restaurants. You can help save your local restaurants by donating to SaveRestaurants.com. And if you can afford it, order directly from those very same restaurants rather than using the popular delivery apps. Or donate to worthy organizations like No Kid Hungry or Feeding America, both of which combat the food insecurity an estimated 54 million Americans are suffering from during the pandemic. If you've enjoyed listening to Sipte Hassan's remarkable story and want more Special Sauce in your life, subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And here's the best part. It's free. So long, serious eaters. See you next time.
Special Sauce is a production of Dot Dash, produced by John Kalish and Ed Levine. Theme music by Charlie Morrow for Morrow Sound.